Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, this is Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. No matter where you are or what you're doing today, you're going to do something. You're going to eat, maybe even three times. When you're in a conflict zone or on a battlefield, that meal reaches a new level of importance. Every soldier has to stop fighting at some time. Every foreign correspondent does too. As one of my next guests put it, meals put war on hold, even if the guns are still firing outside. That is the theme of the new book, Eating Mud Crabs in Kandahar, Stories of Food During Wartime, by the world's leading war correspondents. Journalists with experience all over the world put pen to paper with memorable meals, from tea with Benazir Bhutto to rounds and rounds of Guinness in Northern Ireland, throwing down pints with the IRA. Joining me now are Matthew McAllister, a journalist who edited the collection, and Farnaz Fasihi, senior staff writer for the Wall Street Journal, covering the Middle East, the author of Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq, and she contributed a story to the book. Welcome, guys, to WNYC.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
And listeners, I know we have some correspondents in the audience or some people who have been in the war zones. Give us an idea of breaking bread in a war zone. Maybe you were with an NGO in a far-flung place. Maybe you just found yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time. Give us a call at 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. I know there are great stories out there to match the stories in the book, everywhere from El Salvador to Northern Ireland to Rwanda. So, Matt, the title of the book comes from a story by Christina Lamb. She's the Washington Bureau Chief of the Sunday Times of London. Mud crabs in Kandahar. I'm not familiar. I don't know that I've seen that on the menu, even at some of the more adventurous places down here in Chinatown. What are mud crabs? And how do they taste?
I can't personally tell you, and I kind of don't really want to know. There are quite a few things you won't find on any menu in this book. Christina and a young Hamid Karzai, now the president of Afghanistan, of course, were hunkered down in a trench near Kandahar during the Soviet invasion, and there was a Soviet tank that was pounding their position and keeping them increasingly scared and then increasingly hungry, and they had nothing to eat. And so suddenly some of the Mujahideen who were with Karzai and Christina started digging into the earth, into the mud, and whoa, there are some crabs, and they tucked in.
So did they kill him first? Were they still writhing in the mouth? Do you know? Do you care to know?
I think they were writhing. I'm not totally sure it would make much difference.
Now, I don't know. I don't think that the cover of the book has a picture of Christina eating something. It looks like a watermelon.
It is.
I don't think it's a mud crab.
I know.
But there's a little scoop about who took that picture.
It was indeed the current president of Afghanistan. He's our cover photographer, Hamid Karzai.
Uncredited, but his use of negative space is really quite fascinating.
He's a talented guy.
That's right. And Farnaz, your story is actually more about not eating than eating. Why don't you tell a little bit of it?
The story is about a day where I was heading with a group of Iranian student activists to a restaurant that serves traditional Iranian recipes with a modern twist. It turns stews that are usually cooked with lamb into these creative vegetarian dishes. And it was the student's favorite restaurant. And on the way there, as we were planning to go have lunch there from a press conference, our lunch plans were halted because those students got abducted at gunpoint in front of my eyes. Before we had a chance to get in the car, these two big burly men jumped on the students and put a gun to their heads and took them away. So I didn't eat lunch that day.
And there was a standoff. You thought that you could offer some protection for the students?
That's true. There were some students who were still in the building where we had just left. And as I was standing there with a group of other journalists wondering what we should do, they asked us to go back inside and act as their protection. And we did so. We went in there for about 8 hours trying to be their, protection so they wouldn't raid and arrest them.
Was there evidence that the Iranian security wanted to do that?
Yes, they were standing outside waiting for everybody. And eventually the police chief had to send a team of police officers to escort us home.
And so the big news question is, what happened to the original students who were abducted?
They were held, some for several months, some for years, and accused of plotting to overthrow the regime. And, you know, as I say in the book, there's now a new generation of student activists, and they still go to that same restaurant. It's called the Artist House Cafe in Tehran. And that's where they meet, and that's where they talk about their ideas of democracy and reform.
And I guess the big non-news question, but in keeping with the theme of this book, what do you eat after that eight-hour standoff? Do you remember your meal?
Yes, I came home extremely hungry. and my grandmother had cooked me a delicious stew of eggplant and beef with rice, with saffron rice.
Iran's a pretty good place to cover conflict because the food's good, right?
Yes, the food's really good.
What's known – and so, well, before I ask what's the worst is, I would imagine – I don't know actually the real story, but did the book come out of war correspondents trying to top each other with, oh, you thought you had a horrible meal, listen to this, that sort of thing?
No, it came out – my last book was a sort of food-oriented book, and I chucked in a couple of war food stories in there, and elsewhere had written a few – and found that I had just run out and then of these stories. And suddenly it occurred to me that all of my friends and all of our colleagues have amazing stories as well. And I think I could have maybe, you know, come up with another 60 or 70 of the or more of these stories. I mean, everyone has them. Everyone has, like, several of them. So this is a selection, really, of the – I mean, I'm sure some of the – as you said, some of the listeners out there have their own strange stories. And some of them – some of them are funny, and I think some of them are really quite moving. And there are stories from the Rwandan genocide, from the first Somali famine, from the siege of Sarajevo. What do you eat during a siege that goes on for years? And through this seriousness, there are just great moments of humor. I mean, it's a funny book, I think.
Our number is 212-433-9692. We were just hearing from Matt McAllister, who edited a collection called Eating Mud Crabs in Kandahar, Stories of Food During Wartime by the World's Leading Correspondents. Harry from Queens, you have a tale of food during wartime. Welcome to WNYC, Harry.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick story about Liberia around 1981. It was after the fall of the old regime, but before the Civil War, during the Doe era. The food was absolutely delicious, very hot, and, you know, it's a very, very rich agricultural area. There's lots of food availability. But I lived through a sort of mini famine. There was this sort of, I guess, some sort of speculative thing, and, like, all the rice was withdrawn from the market for about a week. And, you know, places where we had money, we could buy food. There was no food available. I just remember, like, lying in bed holding my stomach because it's been like 3 or 4 days without food. And that experience changed my life because I realized that, you know, as Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winning economist, says that, you know, food, famine isn't the essence of food. There are all these market things that happen, that food is withdrawn from the market, and that sort of changed the direction of my career.
What were you doing in Liberia at the time?
I was there used to be a volunteer program called Crossroads Africa that sent young people, this was like, you know, obviously 30 years ago, sent young people to developing countries for the summer. We were building a school, a group of Americans, you know, with our Liberian partners. And then toward the end of the summer, the rice just disappeared from everywhere.
And
even
so
though, you know, even though the rice was there, but it was like withdrawn from the market.
Yeah. And it changed your career. What did you go on to do?
Well, you know, I was interested in African studies and in sort of understanding agriculture as like a physical thing, you know, how Africans grow crops, and it definitely deflected me more towards economics.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Harry. Thanks very much.
All right.
Mike Peskin on WNYC and for Brian Lehrer speaking about eating mud crabs in Kandahar. Matt, stories in this book where there was, I mean, that's how narrative works, that if it changes the author, it's always a good thing. Are there stories in the book where something like that happened, the I realized that day type story?
I think pretty much all of them are. I mean, there's one story, and it's the final story, that's by Charlie Sennett, who was then of the Boston Globe, and he now is at Global Post. And he and I were in Jerusalem at the same time, and his third son, I think of four, was born in Bethlehem. And recently, Charlie let me know that that son, who I think was then 9 years old, was terribly sick. And so Charlie's, I mean, you couldn't get more transformative than having a son who, by the way, is named Gabriel, born in Jerusalem during the Second Intifada while there were gun battles going on. And then now they're living in Massachusetts, Charlie and his family, and the danger to Gabriel's life in another hospital. And the food part of this that runs its way through Charlie's story is about bread. And Bethlehem means house of bread, and Gabriel, to this day, I believe, is obsessed by challah bread. They have an interesting religious mix in their family. Charlie's wife is Jewish. Charlie is Catholic. They were born, Gabriel can have, I believe, American citizenship, a Palestinian ID card, because mm-hmm. he was born, and Israeli citizenship. And challah bread and the bread of Bethlehem are these things that just resonate so greatly in this little boy's life.
Another really great story in the book, and the story about who wrote it is tragic because it was written by Tim Hetherington, who recently was killed in Libya. But he and Sebastian Younger were on this program talking about their film Restrepo, which is a name of a base in Afghanistan. And so much of his story is about combat. You know, the actual, maybe we don't think about it, but the actual how-tos of eating in the war zone.
Yeah, and all of us who've been embedded with the U.S. military. I mean, really the question was, John Lee Anderson and I were discussing this in the beginning of the sort of birth pains of this book. Who's going to do the MRE story? Someone had to do it. MRE is meals ready to eat, and that's what American soldiers eat when they're out and about away from a base. And they're these weird little cardboard packages, and you open them up and you put a little water in one part, and it becomes insanely hot and scaldingly hot and dangerous. And Tim writes so brilliantly and funnily about the obsessiveness that soldiers have. I mean, they have a deep love-hate relationship with these things because they are frequently disgusting and horrible, and yet that's all you have to survive. And if you're on top of a hill, as he was for a very, very long time with these soldiers, MREs become terribly important. I mean, without them, they would die. I mean, that's all they have to rely on. There were no cookers or ovens up there, and so they obsessed to a sort of fetishistic degree about these packets of food.
They're called, sometimes nicknamed, meals rejected by the enemy, meals rejected by everyone. And if you just had to eat them once, as I did when I've never been a war correspondent but covered Hurricane Katrina, and they give them to people there, well, you know, you get by with one meal. You could eat them once or twice. I think the horror of it is that's the only thing you have to eat. Yeah. And also some of the there are different versions, right? And I think that some of them are better regarded. Maybe it's the beef stew. One of them seems to be the meal that everyone wants, and the other one is the meal that everyone wants to trade for it.
Yeah, I remember being near Fallujah, and you know, there'd be these big boxes of them, and you sort of dive in and push. Oh, you know, I don't want the chicken fajitas. I don't want the curry. You know, oh, it's the burritos, fantastic. But then sometimes it's not, you don't want the burritos, you want the fact that it comes with the peanut butter sachet and the M&Ms, you know, so, and then you have, they all have like little, the chili sauce, I'm forgetting the name, and so you carry around these bulk, you know, little bags of chili sauce all the time, and if you get a dull meal, then you can just chuck that in.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that MREs can also be a taste of home. And I remember in Afghanistan, you know, having been there in, during the war, and just having boiled chicken and flatbread, when I finally got my first packet of mac and cheese MRE, it tasted really, really good. And, you know, it was a memorable meal.
Did it taste like America?
Yes, it tasted like America. It was comfort food in the middle of Afghan mountains.
And, you know, these have a long history. Edward from Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Edward.
Good morning. I was in an infantry platoon in Vietnam in 1970, and we had to eat sea rations, which, as you may know, are canned food. And you talk about preferring certain foods. I recall fruit cocktail was the least desirable of the desserts, whereas canned pears were the thing that everybody seemed to like to eat. And but the thing I wanted to mention was that when we were given these cans of food to eat, we heat them, and so they'd give us little pellets that were sort of like Sterno things to heat up the say the canned chili con carne or something like that. And when I got to my platoon, people told me, well, you know, those Sterno pellets don't work nearly as well as C4. And
explosive?
Yeah. We use C4 to blow up trees to clear landing strips for the helicopters to come and resupply us. And so we always had this C4 stuff lying around. It looks a little bit like ivory soap. And so you could just take a knife and cut off a little slice, and you would light it with a match, and it would burn heat much quicker than the heating tablets things we were given. And only later did I realize that C4 is like the most explosive stuff known to man or something like that. And it was just something we used.
And maybe giving off some fumes that you don't want to be ingesting on a regular basis also.
That never occurred to us either, of course.
Yeah. See, if you overthink things, I don't think the military wants you that much. But, Edward, thanks for the call.
Pleasure.
What about food preparation? What's the strangest story you heard about that? Maybe not the food itself, but the preparation.
Oh, God, that's an awful, awful story. Sam Kiley, and this just isn't funny at all. Sam and a friend of his were in Rwanda and were desperately hungry and reached a border position, and they had managed to find and this is a story about how, you know, extreme things can get, really. Managed to find a chicken, and Sam is a brilliant British correspondent, and he and his friend desperately needed this chicken killed. They didn't know how to do it, and at the border post were some genocidaire, and using a blood-stained machete, one of the genocidaire cut the head off the chicken and cut the chicken up for these guys.
Yeah, and also in that story, there's the here's a quote about some of the meat that was available. No one wanted to eat meat in Rwanda, not with the sweet grilled pork smell hanging in the air. Our guts and throats knew it before our minds could recognize the scent of burned human. No one I know who is in Rwanda then can eat roast pork or, worse still, fried chops. They smell of death. So, yeah, they're fun stories, and there are tough, tough stories in the book. Jeff from New Milford, New Jersey. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, how you doing today? I was in the Marine Corps for 10 years, and a little jar of chili sauce. He was talking about Tabasco sauce.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Thank you.
Right,
yeah.
those little tiny jars, right, that you peel off the plastic
jars
on top, because God forbid they leak, right?
Yeah, it's a staple in Marine Corps food. You find it all on the chow hall tables and everything. And I was in the Marine Corps in the early '80s, and they had just pretty much come out with the MREs. So you got pretty inventive. You started mixing different things, and they're probably pretty limited as far as the menu. So, but we came up with good things. It was actually a lot of fun.
That's the Marine code, right? You got to figure things out as you go along. And we have another call here from J.J. Sutherland, an old producer of On the Media and my pal. Hey, J.J.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm good. We haven't spoken in a couple months, but I'm glad we get the time there.
Hi, J.J.
Hi,
I guess J.J. knows everyone here.
I didn't know you were allowed to call in as your former employer.
No, I was just driving around. I'm here. I'm up in New York for a wedding. And I was in Lebanon during the 2006 war. It was my most bizarre meal. And I just wandered around the southern suburbs of Beirut, which had just been leveled by Israeli bombing, you know, all day. And you sort of, you know, go to refugee camps and, you know, see this, you know, sort of horrific suffering. And yet in Beirut, there was one place that was open called this restaurant called Bread, which was this amazing French restaurant. So you come in, you're sort of covered with dust and rubble. And so me and an NPR correspondent who will go nameless had the Cote de Boeuf, which was perfect.
I know that restaurant, JJ. It's a great restaurant.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, JJ.
Sure. Bye-bye.
See you later. So those, I mean, you get the sense of the scope of the stories and eating mud crabs in Kandahar, stories of food during wartime by the world's leading correspondents. Matt McAllister is one. Matt is, you are the, give your title there, Matt.
I'm, well, I edited came up with this and edited this thing. And I am a freelancer, although I'm about to start a job at Newsweek and the Daily Beast.
Excellent. Great. And one of the contributors who was also joining us, Farnaz Fasihi, thanks very much. You work for the Wall Street Journal in your day job?
I do. I work for the Wall Street Journal in the Middle East. I'm based in Beirut.
All right. Thanks very much. In a minute, we'll talk about the renaissance of the auto industry and what they went through to get here. This is WNYC. Please stay with us.